$30 million a year industry, and the national narrative about violence, political violence in the Middle East, that leads people to be so afraid, mm-hmm. that actually decreases the safety for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
We actually have groups out there advocating that Muslims' civil and religious liberties be limited.
Mm.
That takes away the civil and religious liberties of all of us. And so what we're trying to do, Anila and I, is to push back and create a movement to push back on this fear and on this hatred, and bring greater understanding and compassion for everyone's safety. And so Anila has gone down and has met some of the families that were impacted by that horrific event on the train.
Mm-hmm.
And several times, you know, she's broken down, mm-hmm. weeping for their loss.
Of course.
So when we dehumanize other people,
mm-hmm.
You know, you never know where that's going to start. Once scapegoating gets going in a society, that is walking down a very dark road, and all of us know where that road leads. And it's up to all of us to do our part to say we don't have to walk down that road this time.
That's well said. And before we wrap up, can you where in Vancouver that you and Anila will be this Friday?
Yeah, we'll be at St. Andrew's Lutheran Church in Vancouver at 1 p.m. in the afternoon. The event will last about 2 hours, and we would love to see people there.
All right. Well, Pastor Kylo, thank you so much for joining us. And that's the Anti-Islamophobia Roadshow at Vancouver this Friday.
Okay.
That's right.
Hopefully lots of folks will come out. You said you've had like 40 events like this so far.
Yeah. So, yeah, Anila and I are doing this roadshow right now, and then we're going to do a tour in Eastern Washington. We've got more events in smaller towns planned, and there's big plans across the country for how we can push back on this fear that's going on.
Okay. Thank you so much mm-hmm. for joining us today, Pastor Terry Kylo.
You
and you are with a group that is doing a traveling roadshow across Washington State, and you're making your last stop in Vancouver this Friday, and you're part of Neighbors in Faith. Thank you so much for joining us here on KBOO.
Yeah, thanks, Pastor.
Thank you both. Thanks.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the second annual Know Your City Gala, Untold Stories, on Thursday, November 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the EcoTrust Event Space in Portland. Untold Stories is Know Your City's second annual benefit gala, and it raises essential funds to further Know Your City's programs of engaging everyday Oregonians in the history, culture, and civics of the region. This year's gala will bring together over 150 guests for an unforgettable evening, including hors d'oeuvres, drinks, dessert, performances from local talent, and a paddle raise. Again, that's the second annual Know Your City Gala, Untold Stories, on Thursday, November 16th at 5:30 p.m. at the EcoTrust Event Space, 721 Northwest 9th Avenue, Suite 200 in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Thanks for Giving, a Give Guide Happy Hour with Human Solutions, ERCO, and KBOO on Monday, November 20th at 5 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room in Portland. Human Solutions is partnering with KBOO and ERCO to say thank you to their donors and to celebrate being included in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. The evening includes beer and snacks as a way of saying thanks for giving to all their supporters. Again, that's Thanks for Giving, a Give Guide Happy Hour with Human Solutions, ERCO, and KBOO on Monday, November 20th at 5 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room, 237 Northeast Broadway Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
and you're listening to KBOO Portland, and coming up right now is Preference.
Welcome to Preference, folks. Thanks so much for tuning in tonight. I'm your host, Alan. I want to make note of a couple of things. One, Trans Day of Remembrance events coming up. Go online and take a look and see what's happening and where you can participate. PICA, Portland Institute for Contemporary Art, has a couple of things going on. One is Delta and Doomtown, a series of exhibits. They describe this as a three-day series of events that consider the political past, present, and future of art, AIDS, social justice, and queer life. This is coming up. Begins on November. The events themselves begin on November 29th. There's an accompanying exhibit at PICA's Northeast Hancock space that has already begun. So head out to PICA's website and get some information on this series of events. PICA is also co-hosting with PNCA a separate set of events centered on World AIDS Day. The first is on December 1st. This is an exhibit centered around visual AIDS. It's a nonprofit. And then that same day, Friday the 1st of December, Sarah Schulman will be in town reading from Gentrification of the Mind, a book of hers. There'll be a panel discussion that will include Lisa Bates of PSU, Sherita Town, and Manuel Arturo Abreu. So along with that, there'll be a screening of United in Anger and a History of ACT UP. And on the 2nd, there will be a discussion of Gentrification of the Mind, as well as, Gentrification of the Mind, that apparently will be on December 2nd. And then December 3rd, Sarah Schulman will be back with Conflict is Not Abuse, a reading, and then discussion with the author that folks could participate in. The book is called Conflict is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. I decided sort of as a lead up to these events, Sarah Schulman coming to town for a couple of days of discussion on her work, that I would replay a discussion we had here in the studio with Red and Kat. We aired this earlier this year, a discussion on Conflict is Not Abuse. Kat and Red are both sex worker activists here in town. And later this year, I'll be airing an interview with Sarah Schulman herself. She's someone I've wanted on the show for a long, long time, absolutely a dream guest. I'm very excited. So let's get started with the discussion on Conflict is Not Abuse from earlier this year.
Oh, yeah, sure. Thank you. My name is Kat Salas. I am a local queer celebutant. No, I'm just kidding. I'm a local queer Latinx activist here in the community, as well as a professional sex worker. This past year, I spoke at the National Women's March and have done other projects, including starting the Queer Latinx Publishing House, Casa de Bruja, and probably another handful of things I can never know. My biggest... the thing I really am excited about is getting to be here with Red. We work for SWOC together, which is Sex Workers Outreach Coalition, so I will hand it off to her.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here too. I have been reading this book with agonizing slowness for the last 4 months because I hate it that much. And I am dying to hear from people who really enjoyed it or who found it good. I guess I just want to hear what's going on with that. I'm excited. I work with Kat. I also run Stroll, which is an outreach program. On the weekends, we bring food and hygiene materials to houseless people in the Portland area. And we are also doing an art show this summer. You should come. It's Thursday, June 15th, Pride kickoff. Okay, yeah. Let's get to it.
All right. I want to, I'll read a paragraph from Lenny, which is a... website. This is a piece of writing by Caitlin Greenidge on the book Conflict is Not Abuse. Caitlin writes, I've been excited about her new book, Conflict is Not Abuse, since I heard its premise. Shulman argues that in intimate relationships, in our communities, and in global politics, there is the tendency to, quote, overstate harm, to claim that the most endangered are instead dangerous. This is done to justify making them objects of anxiety, separation, and punishment. The dominant forces, be it an abusive lover in a relationship, a society that insists that citizens would not be killed by police if only they presented themselves correctly, or governments that insist they are being attacked by refugees, the poor, or immigrants, these dominant forces claim their own innocence. And they also assert that those who do not conform are an active threat. So I think that's something we can work ourselves to. The sort of the basis of this book's argument is that distinguishing between what is conflict and what is abuse should enlighten us as to what kinds of actions we can take to remedy, mediate a situation. And what kinds of responses and responsibilities we want to encourage people experiencing conflict or experiencing abuse, what we want to encourage them to think about, or what actions they might take.
Yeah. I mean, theoretically, I'm down with the title, Conflict Isn't Abuse. As an activist in the Pacific Northwest, I have often seen or been accused of bullying when I am making someone uncomfortable. You know, it happens in all activist communities. It's a really good way to shut people down is to say that it's, you know, something that's making you uncomfortable is actually making you unsafe, you know, because we're all so big on safe spaces. That said, you know, I think this is a conversation that needs to happen. I don't think Shulman is the person to start it. I don't know that Shulman has a place in the conversation, given some really telling examples that she gives, both of her own interactions with other people and her frankly invasive reporting on other people's private relationships and what she assumes are their inner thoughts and motivations without any reference to having gotten consent for these or anything like that. So I am finding a lot about this book very troublesome. But yeah, I am here for conversations about conflict not being abuse.
I absolutely agree. To start off on sort of like a positive note, something that I did find to be extremely helpful and interesting in this book is some of the questions that were discussed. Basically, the premise that was brought up was that in understanding abuse, we also have to understand what is not abuse. Mm-hmm. And when we are coming to that conclusion, the most important thing to do is listen and ask questions that allow people to have spaces where they're giving us honest answers without necessarily using words like abuse, conflict, or kind of fear language. And the thing that's a bit unfortunate about that is a lot of those questions actually weren't posed by Shulman. They were posed by Hodes, who I'm trying to find the specific passage, but
I bookmarked one of her quotes too because I was like, "Wow, this is makes total sense." And then I was like, "Oh, it's because Shulman didn't write it."
Yeah. So basically, the conversation that they had been discussing when it came to specifically Hodes advising her students to take alternative questions while they were working as people who were in the community and in social work, instead of saying, "Are you being abused?" which is said, you know, she says, at this point, this can be a meaningless question. Instead, try these, which are asking what is happening when the behavior has occurred, what happened before, what was the outcome, and what was the context? How would you describe your partner? Who makes the decisions, who usually leads up to a fight, and how does a fight usually end? And I really like these questions, thinking back to different examples in my own life where I felt upset or conflicted versus was abused. And I think having conversations and using language that does not assume abuse but also does not obscure abuse is a really important tool. The only problem with that for me personally was that I don't think Shulman touched on enough concrete examples of how to do this throughout the book. And I will say that before I even get any further into this conversation, I do want to acknowledge that I came into this with a fair amount of bias because I am a queer Latinx indigenous person. And so I just feel anytime someone says, oh, this is a book that you're going to like and it's by a white person, I definitely take a second. I'm like, well, we'll see. But I will say, coming in with that, the problem for me, you know, even though at the root of it may be her privilege or her whiteness, was way more her just inability to actually have concrete and accessible points.
My friend actually is an academic, and she was like, you know, sometimes I'll mine her work for quotes, but it's always a thing where she's so sloppy that, like, I'm taking quotes from her, but her actual examples are useless. And I was like, I'm paraphrasing. I can't remember what she said exactly, but I was like, that makes sense. I see that here. This is the only book by her I've read, but I can see that.
I think one of the really important distinctions to make in this book, by the way, we're talking about conflict is not abuse, overstating harm, community responsibility, and the duty of repair by Sarah Shulman. I think one of the important distinctions, and Shulman certainly hits this, is that when we're thinking about how to help folks identify what's conflict and what's abuse and what to, where to go with that, I guess, to to use a non-concrete phrase, is that these questions come up in interpersonal relationships as well as in social experiences, whether that's politics at large, as a nation or as a community, whether it's in an activist community. One example that's of trying to figure this out just really recently that's been salient for me and something I've been really thinking about is, you know, I've got a friend who had a really bad experience with somebody and that they had an economic relationship with and believed that they were subject to abuse. From the outside, it just looked like conflict to me. So I've been thinking about, like, how to have that conversation with this person so that they can, so that they have the opportunity to hear something that can help them reframe this so that it's not as, damaging to their experience. But also it gives them opportunity to say, okay, if I took a different perspective, what might my behavior have looked like that was different? Or where was my responsibility in this? You know, what did I do to generate conflict? And if I did I then claim it as abuse? The details don't matter, but they're sort of a mild example of the kinds of experience that folks can have. Yeah, so I think actually, in terms of that, Shulman's book helped me come closer to sort of figuring out what kinds of points I want to make with this person. I didn't intervene in the situation sort of while it was happening because my sense was that nothing really bad could happen in the short term, you know, but it's something I want this person to go back and review and, you know, give some thought to and decide whether they want to tell a different story about it, if that's meaningful for them or possibly meaningful. Yeah. So that's sort of the personal side of it.
Yeah. I think there are a lot of points that are made in this book that on a personal scale did resonate with me. Mm-hmm. One of the things that they talked about that I really was excited to hear and felt very, very validating to see just put onto paper was the idea of power dynamics. Mm-hmm. And that when you talk about power dynamics, when you're talking about abuse, you have to do it kind of in two tiers. And the first one is acknowledging that there may be a power difference. And the other one is acknowledging how it's being sort of yielded, because having power alone is not necessarily going to lead to abuse. wielding power or using power that you have over another person is mm-hmm. abuse. And so that was something that was really interesting to me, because when we look at different relationships, especially if you're talking like from something like an HR perspective, even when you're looking at, I've done workshops about sex positivity and client relations and stuff like that. I think that whole idea of, just because someone, especially coming from the sex industry, and I feel like Matilda, you could comment on this, just because there are situations where someone might have more power, like acknowledging if they're using it is an important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And also understanding that, like, if you are in a position where someone has more power than you, that it is more potentially abusive. And even further than that, we have to look at how those people get the power. So maybe mm-hmm. The secret that, you know, I didn't really feel Shulman touched on as much as she could have, was that, how do we even out the power dynamics between people? Mm-hmm. And a really concrete example of this is, we can look at underage sex work. So right now, anytime someone buys sex or sex acts or solicits sex or sex acts from someone that's underage, it is considered prostitution, because trafficking because minors can't give consent to.
And trafficking is the sort of higher level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
more criminal.
It's more criminal. And a lot of times it's a federal offense. And the flip side of that is, when a youth does perhaps solicit someone and that person is charged with trafficking, because that youth can't have consent, that youth can still be charged with prostitution. So if we look at this idea of who has the power in that, we see it's very obvious that the adult has more power than the youth. And if we want to, and we're saying that there is abuse going on because the adult in soliciting sex from someone who is under the age of 18 is an abuser, because they can't consent, you mm-hmm. know? And so if we want to move forward with that, we would need to then have something that has more power, like the state, to empower the youth, perhaps by taking away the potential for a prostitution charge, and therefore evening the playing field. Does that seem like it could make sense? Or that's at least something that I was thinking of when I saw that example?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense to me, especially with the power dynamics between like social services and young people and the courts. Again, like, they're making victims of the wrong people and refusing to help the right people. I would call it an abusive system. It's one that makes me very depressed. When I was reading it, I was thinking back to my experience at the crisis line here, and, you know, how I was asked to leave because I made someone feel unsafe because I said that I didn't understand straight people. And in the end, I got escorted off the premises because I made someone feel so unsafe by saying that. And how, when I tried to talk about it, I was told that that was abuse and I was being very bullying. And, you know, who has the power in that situation? Is it the person who commented that they didn't understand straight people, or is it the people who are made to feel unsafe because suddenly they see that they're straight and they have power in a situation with somebody? It's interesting. I mean, I think it's such an interesting subject, and she doesn't do nearly enough with it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest problems with this book, is that she isn't giving specific example. She's not acknowledging the fact that if we're talking about an individual having power over another individual, we have to understand that there are specific power dynamics that are at play. And she uses a lot of these very vague, very very sort of like all-inclusive statements, like a friend of mine, a woman, a trauma, in a situation, two coworkers. And by taking it to this like utmost hypothetical level, it almost makes it totally invalid, in my opinion. I'll give you an example. If we're talking about, you know, almost what she said, she gives this, I wonder if I can find it.
There's a couple examples of that where she just talks about friends of hers, and she gives a little bit of background about them, but I felt that it was really invasive, and B, there was so much speculation about what was happening in their heads that I didn't think that it really stood up as an example. You know, if it had been an interview where the person was saying, yes, I felt this, you know, and if there had been quotations, that might have gone a long way to allaying my fears and repercussions. Anyway, how I felt about that, reservations. But as it was, she's just kind of like, oh, these are my assumptions about these people whose intimate lives I am now going to tell you about. And it just made me feel a little odd.
Yeah, I think her example was about phone calls.
Oh.
And how she believes that we should, you know...
This was a particularly egregious example, by the way. If you haven't read the book, it's basically one long vague blog about somebody who didn't call her and it hurt her feelings. So yeah, I'll let you go on.
Yeah, it seems like she met an individual. This is the information that she gives. They had lunch together. She said that she really liked the conversation and that they... she had told him that she would love to talk on the phone with them again. And apparently it was very, it was difficult for her because they had seemed originally like they were interested in calling her back, but then she tried to make concrete plans and they didn't want to. And she was like, if I push it anymore, I could be considered to be the abuser, but like, that's not correct in this situation. And because we don't have details about this other person, we can't actually make the argument because she's asking us to assume, number one, that she's right. And I'm sorry, but because of my background, I'm never interested in assuming that, like, a highly educated, upper-class, privileged white woman, even if she is queer, necessarily has the right opinion.
Plus, you know, Aziz, this is a whole line in Aziz, I'm sorry, is comedy about how, like, millennials don't call people back. We just ghost on people. I'm like, it's also your age difference, granny. Like, that's not a...
But it's like, you know, when you're talking about something so vague, you're not touching on all these other important things. And age is one of them. Mm-hmm. You know, culture is another one. Race, involvement in the LGBTQ community. Background.
Yeah.
Power dynamics like that, where they hold jobs. If I'm saying that there's that exact situation, someone is calling someone a bunch of times and that first person says it's abuse, Sarah Schulman might say, using her example, you know, no, it's not. That's conflict. Now, if I told you that the person calling the entire time was a 50-year-old white straight man and the person that was being called was a 21-year-old African-American woman who was his student, then we would see that that was an abusive situation. And she doesn't give us information. I think it's almost kind of falling into that, like, color blindness theory of we don't have to talk about these things because, you know, they're not relevant to her. And honestly, the time that it really hit me hardest is in that conversation she's talking about, you know, she says, don't people have an obligation to sort of like
maintain contact, or
let me find it.
I know what you're referring to because I read an essay on the same subject. It went viral in like January, so maybe you've read it by somebody else who I think was a queer woman of color, and she did a much better job of talking about how we do have an obligation to our human community to try and maintain connections, especially when we're part of a marginalized community and we're so vulnerable already. And I wish that I had thought to print that out because I thought she did a really good job, and it was a much shorter, you know, maybe it was because it was shorter and succinct and she had a very specific point. I thought that was good. And I could see the connections to Sarah Schulman while I was reading it. I was like, this is kind of what she's getting at, but she did a much better job.
So, I found the quote. Is that okay if I go ahead?
Yeah, just let me let folks know that you're listening to Preference here on KBOO. You're entirely invited to call in and share your thoughts. 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. If you have... something you want to add, please give us a call.
Please.
Yeah. Ken?
Oh, I was going to say, I did find that quote that we have been talking about, and Sarah Schulman says, don't people have some responsibility to be accountable? And she's so shocked by this. She's so shocked in her life.
Upon.
No, but like literally what she says is responsibility to be accountable. And when I read that, I was like, that's such an interesting thing that you're shocked by the fact that people are not held accountable. Because I think specifically to POC communities, we have lived our entire lives
in a world mm-hmm. that enslaved us, that murdered us, that allows police to come into our schools, to raid our like neighborhoods, to deport us unjustly, and no one's ever held accountable. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, are you actually surprised? You really think that we live in a world where people are held accountable to their actions? What about America makes you feel like anyone has ever been held accountable?
Well, and also just the idea that not calling her back is something that you need to be held accountable for. I mean, you know?
Maybe she was just kind of like, she seems like she's being a lot. Like, I read this and I was like, if someone like called me 4 times and I didn't answer them, I'd probably be like...
It's the age difference, I think. Like, because back in the day, you had to call people on the phone if you ever wanted to talk to them. Now we've got texting.
You're listening to Preference. I'm your host, Alan, and we're listening to a recorded interview with Red and Kat, local yokels. We're talking about Sarah Schulman's book, Conflict is Not Abuse. Sarah will be here in a couple of weeks for World AIDS Day events. It looks like she'll be speaking on the 2nd, reading from Gentrification of the Mind, a book well worth reading. I have it here with me. I'm going to start rereading it tonight. There'll be a panel discussion, also a screening of United in Anger, A History of ACT UP. And then on the 3rd, Sarah will be reading from Conflict is Not Abuse, along with a guest-moderated discussion, we're told. So head out to PICA and PICA's website and get the actual details. The email that PICA sent out doesn't have enough that I can guide you where you need to go. So, but you have a few weeks until then. We'll be back on here on Preference on the 28th. We'll be doing a 2-hour World AIDS Day discussion. And then later this year, and sometime in December, I'm finally going to be able to air an interview with Sarah Schulman. I'm very excited. Let's get back to our discussion, recorded discussion with Red and Kat on Sarah Schulman's book, Conflict is Not Abuse.
She says at one point that we should never talk to anyone that we can't see if we want to within 3 days, something like that. And I was like, so, like, are airplanes bad? You know, what about email? Oh, she doesn't like email. It's just really odd, some very odd statements.
I was very upset that she didn't talk more about how millennials and people that use the internet can communicate better, because saying we shouldn't, that text and email isn't a viable form of communication seems like a little bit archaic, because it's sort of ignoring the fact. Yeah, I mean, if we look at some of the protests that happened in Syria that were completely mobilized because of social media, if we see movements like the Black Lives Matter movement that have a very strong root on a social media platform, we can see very crucial examples of ways that social media has influenced the ability of marginalized people to network and
to hold people accountable. I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure she would hate it, but like, there's a lot of abusers that we've been able to find and hold accountable because of networking through the internet. I feel positive that she would hate that and would want to argue it, but you know, it's true. So. But
yeah, I was like, I mean, I'm 21 years old. I don't remember the last time I called someone on the phone, unless it was like my mom or my sister, and we just do that so we can like talk at each other and yell at my sister in Spanish in the supermarket. Like, I just would be really interested to hear, you know, more about that face to face.
Wait. Do we have a commercial break coming up?
We're going to listen to some music in just a moment. We are Preference Radio talking about Sarah Schulman's book, Conflict is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes. We're going to have a little musical break.
from the hand protects us all. At the ready to answer a call in his own special way.
Thanks, folks, for being here with us. Glad to have you on the radio. We are Preference Radio, and we are talking about Sarah Schulman's new book, Conflict is Not Abuse, Overstating Harm, Community Responsibility, and the Duty of Repair. This book is a finalist for the Publishing Triangle's Judy Grann Award for Lesbian Nonfiction. There's lots of reviews on it online, so you can take a look and see what some thoughts about this book are, some other thoughts, and I'm going to come back to a little discussion of very salient politics, yeah, related to Trump, that Sarah herself had some stuff to say, so we'll fit that in later. But we've got Red and Kat here in the studio. We're going to pick up with
Red. I'm Red, and so there's this part very early on in the book that kind of prejudiced me against it from, you know, early on. I read it and I just thought, you know, if I didn't know that this was, an older lesbian woman who'd done a lot of activism around HIV and queer community, I would think that this was an MRA, a men's rights advocate, writing about, you know, being an involuntary celibate and how unfair the world is. So I'm going to quote a little bit. Schulman is at some conference and someone is sitting across from her who has insights that are attention grabbing, and she displays herself in a way that may be aimed at the larger group, but it's having an effect on me. We are all talking business, but she is a bit naughty. This is a professional gathering inside an institutional building, yet the woman across the way uses the word G-spot. Now, queer people have a sexualized vocabulary in professional spaces that many straight people might find inappropriate, so this stands out as a bit showy, but not unusual. Then, the more she insists that we think about this G-spot, the more I begin to think about penetrating her, and I'm also thinking about her penetrating me. Is she flirting with me? I'm the stranger here, the others are her workmates. I don't know if she's always like this, or if this is for my benefit. Is she innocent of being sexually aggressive, or is she guilty? I have to be very, very careful. I'm skipping around here. She's having a lot of hypotheticals about if she enjoys her and appreciates her, and she could be seen as the harasser. So Shulman has to be very, very careful. One false move and I could be the sad object of an outraged story on the dreaded grapevine. Sarah Shulman came on to me. It was so inappropriate. The story would never be, I liked her, I flirted her, she understood me, and then I was scared I would be hurt like I have been before. And so right there, Shulman starts a line of thought that she continues for the next, until the end of the chapter, I believe, about how women aren't abused or assaulted as often as we say we are. More often, it's that we were flirted with and we didn't think we could handle it and we were afraid, so we instead claim to have been assaulted. And I'm looking at this and thinking, you know, if I was having a conversation at a conference in a professional capacity, even if I used the word G-spot, I would not be expecting to have anybody involved in the conversation start thinking about penetrating me. That's, I mean, dare I say inappropriate? Like, you don't know me like that. I'm not giving you permission. I'm a sex worker. So there are very specific situations in which I feel comfortable being sexualized, but at a professional conference that is not sex work profession, no, you don't need to think that. You definitely don't need to publish your thoughts about thinking about penetrating me. And the concern that she is the one who could get in trouble for acting on these thoughts, I find absurd. And that's the line of thought that she continues throughout the rest of the book for the most part. She says sometimes that we must ask why people feel the need to describe themselves as abused. Which is, you know, it's a question, but in the culture of domestic violence that we have today, it's not the right question, I don't think. Shulman feels otherwise. So what were your thoughts?
Honestly, I wish that I had a book written by Hodes, because it seems like every time that Shulman has these like somewhat problematic statements, that she almost backs them up with other writers mm-hmm. or other activists who have almost like in my opinion, a better perspective, because I think it really goes back to not asking, like, were you abused, but being able to recognize what is abuse and mm-hmm. what isn't. And by just being good listeners and making sure that there are multiple people with multiple backgrounds hearing someone's story, then, like, but I also think it's a really dangerous game, number one, to listen to an individual who's so comfortable sexualizing another person to the point of saying penetration, which in itself is, like, I think a very violent word, but like having that discussion, having that, and then publishing it, it does like, I think, speak to her character a little bit. And I'm not sure if I can sympathize with someone who is talking about being almost like holding the idea of abuse to a higher level of scrutiny while they're objectifying a person and then publicly talking about it without that person's consent. And I don't think that giving someone anonymity in like as the same as asking their consent, especially if you're this type of writer.
I feel like I'm just looking at what I bookmarked here.
We have our first caller.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Oh my gosh.
Maura?
Yeah.
Welcome.
Hi.
I just figured I'd call in because I definitely have a different opinion from your guests. I'm reading Conflict is Not Abuse right now, and I haven't finished it, but I'm getting a lot out of it, and I thought I would lend an opposing view to the conversation.
Sure.
So, yeah, just a couple of points that to respond. I think, so for one, Sarah Shulman, she does, as all her nonfiction books, which I've read just a few, she talks about coming from like an undisciplined place. Like, it's not an academic book, so she doesn't do a lot of like quotes and like, you know, research and all that stuff. It's more and she talks about how it really comes from her personal experience. Like, this is her lived experience. So I think just like adding that and like sort of taking it with a grain of salt, like, you can't necessarily say that it's, you know, she's missing all these things. She recognizes that. I think there's value to having that. And then I just wanted to, the communication piece, like, I feel like what she's saying is it's not that she doesn't think email or the internet are important tools, but when you're talking about trying to solve conflict, or when you're dealing with issues that are emotional or charged, it's not productive to try to solve them via text or email, because you miss out on so much, like tone. Like, you can say something, you can write something, but without actually hearing, you know, the vulnerability in the voice, or, you know, like the gestures. And I really feel like that's a cross-generational thing. And I wanted to just gently say that calling her a granny is pretty ageist. Those are just some of my initial, comments.
Thank you so much.
I don't really have a whole lot of response to that. There, you know, when I'm in conflict with people, I like as much space as possible. I don't like to meet up with them in person because it stresses me out. I just like to have email conversations whenever possible. You can say a lot more. You can think about what you're saying. So I think, as well as generational, it's also entirely personal. And we were actually talking in the break about how her insistence that you can't shun people. And I love how shunning is this terrible thing. But you can't shun people because that's not fair to them. And when in reality, you know, the reality is a lot of abusers don't deserve to not be shunned. You know, like, sometimes people give up their option of being in your life. And that's true. There's no reason to keep people in your life if they're damaging you, whatever she says.
Recognizing the generational thing, like, she does come from a time when a lot of queer people that came out during that time were shunned by their family and everyone that they knew.
Would you mind repeating that? I'm sorry, I think there's just a little, I couldn't quite hear you, but I really want to listen to what you're saying.
So, she comes from, you know, a generation where being queer and coming out to your family oftentimes meant that you were, like, shunned from your whole family and everyone that you knew. And so I think that, you know, I think about that in that context. And I also think, like, it comments on the disposability that we have in our culture, that it's so easy to just, like, say whatever, like, and basically just end relationships when they become uncomfortable or conflicted, which I think is a real barrier to forming, you know, to sustain community, especially activism, because you are going to have interpersonal conflict when you are working with people closely. I think that's the whole point, is, like, you know, you have to learn those really important skills and being able to resolve them. But so often people are just like, okay, whatever, like, they're just too complicated, their trauma's too big, they're, you know, like, yeah, and they just become ostracized from the community. And so, yeah.
Do you have any examples that you're thinking of when it comes to ostracization? I think that's right. From activist communities, is there something that's standing out for you?
Well,
where folks had to, you know, figure out the contours.
Yes, I mean, I think. I'm trying to think of an example where I don't want to, like, use a specific example without someone's consent. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's just, like, that call out culture, I think, and people get really, or that experience of being shunned because they made a mistake. Like, I guess I'm thinking about, this happened over Facebook in a group where someone admitted to making a mistake. It was in, like, I don't want to give too many specifics, but, like, in a organizing group, and people just kind of really, they were like, how could you do this? How dare you? You know, and that person was, like, afraid to, like, show up in meetings and in spaces. And partly I think that happened.
Maura, we've dropped you. Thank you for calling in. You can call back if you like. We would welcome that. The question I was going to ask her, so I'll put it out here, is, how do we intervene? Like, what sort of responsibility do we have to either, to, you know, engage our communities in trying to sort out what's conflict and what's abuse? And I think there are times in my life where I've had relationships where I've been confused about that, and people aren't always they don't always come with the set of skills that can help other people figure out what kinds of thinking folks should have about negative experience. And then how, you know, what kind of intervention do we have? I'll put air quotes around intervention when it comes to interpersonal relationships. And Shulman in this book, Conflict Is Not Abuse, speaks specifically about domestic violence and essentially state workers, but I think she means to include sort of extended state workers, we'll call it nonprofit groups, and how they interact with domestic folks who experience domestic violence. Mm-hmm. So it's a sort of a two-part question, you know, or more. You know, how do you be someone who can be a responsible participant in a conversation when somebody or some group needs to sort out what's an experience of conflict and what's an experience of abuse?
Oh, cool. Yeah. Who do we have? Morna's back. 'Cause the call.
Can you hear us?
Yeah. Sorry about that.
That's okay. We were just we were talking about how to intervene. Like, where do you get the skills, and when do you know how to use them, and when do you know how to walk away from a situation where you can't really help, even though you want to. You know, what does that look like? And I think Shulman gives some hints, but it's a much bigger topic that I think the book doesn't entirely cover.
Yeah, while we were talking about this, I was thinking about some drama that happened in Facebook and mostly on the internet, but also in person over the Portland Women's March, and how unbelievably racist so many of those women were being, and how if you called them racist, they would flip out and accuse you of abusing them and of being violent. And not wanting them to be part of the revolution. It's on and on and on. And, you know, so that's one of the things that I think we really need to address, like conflict. Being called a racist, is not, it's not abuse, it's not bullying, it's usually just a statement of fact. And also, B, how that was used to shut down actual legitimate critiques of the racism within our movement. So that was my first, I mean, my take is that white people need to cool it and listen, take several big steps back and listen to what other people have to say without feeling abused.
I absolutely agree. I think that one of the biggest things we can do when it comes to sort of evaluating abuse is, number one, recognizing what is and what isn't abuse. And a huge part of that, there's this thing with call-out culture that it's like oftentimes very vague. And that's one of the reasons that call-out culture is something that I think can be really dangerous, because I've seen a lot of examples of individuals calling other people out on the internet. For those of you who aren't familiar with what call-out culture is, it's the idea of using social media platforms to call out things like sexual assault. Usually one person openly like tags another person as being an abuser in any way. And the idea of it, I think, can be very positive. However, because there's a thing where there's just not a lot of specifics involved, and it's difficult for me on the internet where there is more anonymity. It's different than if someone who I know well comes and says it. It's like, I think if you're communicating through text, if you're communicating in an email, there does need to be more specific so that people can evaluate what you have to say. And I am not saying that you have to validate your abuse. And I'm not saying that you have to prove it. But it is something that I struggle with because I am a millennial. I am part of the, you know, I love the internet. But I have seen call-out culture ruin people's lives, and it comes out afterwards that perhaps had all the information been there, maybe people would have made different opinions. And I've also seen it be incredibly successful. Sort of moving on from that too is the whole idea of what Red was talking about earlier when it came to the Women's March. And I will go ahead and comment on that. First off, I want to shout out to the incredible women and people. Margaret Jacobson is a really amazing individual who helped plan the Women's March. And it was a huge honor. I actually was able to go and speak at the Women's March. I was the youngest person and the only sex worker that spoke at the Portland Women's March. It was very exciting. And I was faced with a huge amount of opinions from predominantly white women, not only about my background as a sex worker, but about my background as a Latinx person. And it was very frustrating. The interesting thing is that I think there were actually more white women saying that they were feeling abused by me than them saying that that I was uneducated, the like making fun of me, sort of for like maybe fitting into some sex worker tropes. And I didn't feel abused by that. And I think that the thing that we have to look at is that a lot of the time we recognize abuse because we feel uncomfortable. And we also recognize conflict because we feel uncomfortable, but it starts there, you know? You're like, okay, this isn't right. But being abused for certain attitudes or certain events can be normalized. And she talks about this, if you're sitting out with the book, it's on page 62. And she says, are you unsafe or uncomfortable?
Good question.
And that's a good question. But I feel like the problem is that safety and comfortability are dependent on what is normalized for you. And so as someone who has had, you know, this experience of people making comments about my ethnic background as well as my work as a sex worker being very normal, I didn't feel really anything about it. I didn't feel uncomfortable or unsafe. I was like, this is my existence. But for them, being called out on being racist did make them feel uncomfortable, which I can't say if that's wrong or right, and misinterpreted as unsafe because it's not something they've experienced. And so we get into this thing that it almost seems like comfortability and safety can be a bit elitist in that way. Is something that's something that bothered me, is how do we make, when people have such different experiences and such different ideas of normal, of what is comfort and what is safe, I think that's directly reflected in the fact that people who have more privilege tend to view what is conflict and what is abuse differently than people that have less privilege, even though people that are more marginalized are the more commonly abused people, both by individuals and by systems as a whole.
We're going to come back to that point in just a moment. Maura, are you still with us?
Yeah, I am.
Do you want to add anything here, or?
Yeah, I mean, I really appreciate hearing your story about your experience at the Women's March, and I do think it's really sad that people, I mean, that's just like part, I think it's part of white people becoming aware of structural racism and like the whole white fragility thing. And I think that's one of the areas too where the book is a little problematic. And I think people, you know, I can see how it can reinforce like this either apologism around abuse or like not believing a survivor's story, like that sort of like, well, are you sure? Because there's already such a huge history of that. And even though like in Portland, you know, the like in Multnomah County, they've done a lot of good work in DV services, but especially if you're white, like if you're a person of color is experiencing DV, it's still very problematic to like get the police or state involved, obviously, in getting and seeking support or safety. And yeah, I guess I wanted to just bring up one other point from the book and hear what you guys had to thought. Think about it, the chapter or the section where she talks about supremacy and how that plays out in trauma and how they can look different or can look similar even though they come from very different places.
Indeed. Like, that was actually the next thing I was going to come to. I've got a quote.
Cool.
From an interview again with Caitlin Greenidge. So I'm going to go ahead and read these several paragraphs that Sarah herself contributed to this conversation at the website called Lenny. Okay, so Sarah says, unfortunately, the election has in many ways proven the thesis of the book. On one hand, we have a bully Trump, who is constantly telling us how victimized he is, especially when some person or a media outlet tells the truth about him, he lashes out at them as unfair or assaultive. At the same time, we have a group of people, working class and poor whites, who are actually oppressed, who have projected their anxieties into blaming immigrants, the very folks who are absolutely not responsible for the loss of factory and industrial jobs. This construction fits exactly into my book's analysis that there are two entities involved in calling difference abuse: the supremacist and the traumatized. The supremacist, Trump and his ilk, cannot tolerate difference, opposition, or being asked to question themselves, or to explain inconsistencies or lies. They feel entitled to never have to be self-critical or accountable. And we see this in the intimate realm as well, in cliques or communities or families. But unrecovered, traumatized people can also be a mirror image of these behaviors, because sometimes when we are hurt, ourselves are so fragile and it is so hard to keep it together that any request to rethink our assumptions feels like an attack.
I honestly, utterly, totally despise her equivocation of, like, you know, white voters with abused people. I mean, in a way it fits, but in a way, like, her whole domestic violence comparison, it just doesn't work. She's not engaging with actual reality, and which is, like, most often it's the survivor and the victim who is the one who, you know, gets sent to jail, gets the cops called on them, gets evicted, gets killed. You know, like, her insistence that we not believe women who say that they've been assaulted just offends me, and I hate it. But on the other hand, you know, I know that this is something Melissa Geer Grant really appreciated about the book. She said that it was really relevant to all the claims that Trump was gaslighting people last year, and that was not, in fact, what was happening. Trump wasn't gaslighting anyone since the facts were easily available. That was, as far as I could tell, it was the only thing she liked about the book. It's the only thing she mentioned anyway. I think it would have been a much better book if she had picked either one or the other to focus on. You either focus on state violence, cop violence, Israel and Palestine, or you focus on